Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson says, "Black America as we knew it," quoting him here, "is history." He says there was once a common thread, a common black experience, and it's largely gone. Now black Americans, he says, are a lot like all Americans, rich and poor, middle class and immigrant, not the same exactly in their experiences, in their challenges, but not what they were. They're in college and in jail, immigrants and biracial, in the White House, in despair. This hour On Point, Eugene Robinson and the splintering of black America. You can join the conversation. Do you see black America breaking up, broken up, going separate ways? What's that mean for African Americans, for all Americans? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Eugene Robinson joins us today from Seattle, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. Eugene Robinson, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
Disintegration. Well, when we think of the black Americans, African Americans, integration, it's about blacks and whites. But you're talking inside the black community, if we can still use that phrase. And what do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about what I believe I've seen happen in my lifetime, what has happened in the last 50 years to the African-American community. There was a time during the Civil Rights Movement when it made sense to talk about black America as an entity that you could make coherent sentences about. You could say that it was poorer than white America. You'd say it was less educated. You knew where we lived because we lived in segregated neighborhoods,
right,
almost exclusively. We African Americans who had gone to college for the in the majority had gone to historically black universities because we had not by choice, but often by law, where I grew up in the South, lived in a segregated world. Because of the Civil Rights Movement and its triumph, and because of lots of other things that happened over the last 50 years, we've had other options, and those who have been most able to take advantage of those options have done so. And one of those options has been to physically move away from those historically black neighborhoods. Many people have had educational and employment opportunities that would have been impossible in years past. Indeed, a career like mine would have been impossible in years past, and like that of many black professionals. And as a result, there's been disintegration is what is the word that I used of what had been a more unitary black America.
You're sharing here in an interesting way. I mean, we'll look at exactly how you describe this splintering, and it is really interesting. But it comes into everyday life. I mean, even just walking down the sidewalk, what you grew up kind of expecting within that sort of what visible or invisible orb of being black in America, and how even that has changed for somebody like you. There's a little bit in just at the top of your nearly chapter 10, Eugene, I wish you'd read for us. I think it will give everybody a sense. If you're black, you may recognize this. If you're not, this may be kind of insight into what this disintegration is meaning.
Sure, be glad to. It has been the custom for as long as I can remember, when a black person is walking down the sidewalk, particularly in a mostly white environment, the business district of a city like Denver, say, or a trendy shopping strip in Santa Monica, and meets another black person walking in the opposite direction, it's natural for these strangers to acknowledge each other with a small gesture or a mumbled greeting as they pass. We don't go out of our way for these encounters, and there's certainly nothing obligatory about them. Often they barely even register, although I guess I may have as many as a dozen in the course of a day. Usually, at least for me, all that's involved is the making of eye contact followed by a quick nod of the head. The whole thing isn't much more than a reflex, but it feels satisfying. If I had to explain, I'd say it was an affirmation of something shared, something remembered, something understood, something cherished. It is an acknowledgement that even as total strangers, what we have in common is our racial identity. But I have to wonder if that is still true. I have to ask whether black Americans, divided as they are by the process of disintegration, still have enough shared experiences, values, hopes, fears, and dreams that they define and claim a single racial identity and feel a racial solidarity powerful enough to connect, if only for an instant, strangers who may never see each other again. I give the little nod without even thinking about it. Is it my imagination, or are fewer people nodding back?
Eugene Robinson, reading from his new book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. And you give us quite an answer to that question. I mean, fewer are nodding back, and there are reasons. Give us the quick outline of...
It's odd, but there's one figure that came out in a Pew research survey and several years ago that really confirmed me in my thinking about this book and impelled me to do it. They did a survey of African Americans, and 37% said they believed that African Americans could no longer be thought of as a single race. And I wonder, well, what in the world does that mean? There weren't really follow-up questions, so it was impossible to kind of know or tease out what exactly they were talking about. Clearly, they were talking about economic separation, but what else? And so, in part, I was trying to figure out what that sort of incredible number meant, 37%.
Yeah. And you found your answer. You come up with four big categories. Nothing in life is as simple as categories. We know that. But you're trying to sort of describe what's happened here, and I wish you'd lay those out for us, Gene. So if it's splintered, right, what do the big splinters look like?
Well, these are the splinters that I identified, and you're right, nothing is more simple than categories. But here's what I found. I poured through census data and everything I could get my hands on, and I found that there is a majority of African Americans, not a huge majority, but a majority, 55-60%, whatever, who have reached the middle class, not full parity with white America. We can add all the caveats and the asterisk, but basically who are middle class Americans, and if you look at their demographic profile in terms of income and all of that, you could compare them to Canada, for example, and this group I call the mainstream,
the middle class, whatever middle class means right now.
Exactly. I mean, and right. The big asterisk at the moment is, of course, the effects of the recession, which is knocking a bunch of people out.
But even with that question, that's quite a statement. Mm-hmm. You're saying more than half, a majority of African Americans, given this country's history now, mainstreamed.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think the figures bear that out. There is, however, a too large minority. I would say conservatively 25%, maybe a bit more. Certainly, I'd say you'd say a bit more now, given the state of the economy, who did not make the climb into the middle class, and for whom the prospects of making that climb are, I believe, dimmer than they have been certainly in 50 years, maybe in 100 years, simply because the rungs of that ladder that they're supposed to climb are no longer there. The blue-collar jobs in those kinds of neighborhoods that people used to raise themselves and their families.
You call them the abandoned.
I call them the abandoned, yes. And they're the abandoned because the nation has essentially abandoned them and forgotten about them. And we don't talk about them a lot. We don't talk about poverty in this country a lot. And we certainly don't talk about it in this race-specific way anymore.
So there's your mainstream and your abandoned. And then two other tiers, which are really, well, I guess not exactly new. There's always been the talented 10th idea, but even so.
Yes, it goes beyond the talented tent. There's a group that I call the Transcendent Group, and this is a very small but elite who have attained wealth, power, or influence in the society on a scale that I think was simply impossible in years past. When W.E.B. Du Bois was talking about the talented tent, he was referring to people who were indeed talented, and some were people of means and whatever, but not on the scale, not on the scale of the first African American president of the United States, or not on the scale of Oprah Winfrey or Richard Parsons, former head of Time Warner, chairman of Citibank, not on the scale of having that sort of wealth, power, or influence in terms of the whole society, rather than just relative to other African Americans.
And you've got one more. We'll look at all these. You've got one where you call it emergent, and it really kind of breaks the mold.
Yeah, it does, Tom. And it's got two basic components of the emergent group, I think. One consists of immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa and their sons and daughters. There has been a huge wave of immigration from the Caribbean. That's not all that new, but what's really new is an influx of African immigrants.
So black, but without the American experience of slavery in their families.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and it's a very interesting group of people. Immigrants from Africa constitute the best educated group of immigrants coming to this country today, better educated than the Asians, the Europeans, the Latin Americans, any other regional group you can think of. They often arrive here without a lot of money, but they come in generally in intact families, and their children in particular are doing extremely well. And
also in that emerging,
well
in that emergent group, you also have the biracial. We'll look to the White House and beyond with Gene Robinson. His new book is Disintegration, the Split Splintering of Black America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson. His new book is Disintegration, the Splintering of Black America. He joins us today from Seattle, Washington. Gene, let's go right to our callers. Nashville, Tennessee. Kevin, you're on the air with Eugene Robinson.
Hey, glad to be on your program.
Great to have you.
Maybe one overall comment. There's a lot that could be said about the idea of a disintegration. I mean, that really was something that was true from the very beginning as far as the experience of Africans brought to this country. I mean, the idea that somehow they were all the same is pretty inaccurate. But the thing that did unify their experience was American racism. I mean, it didn't matter where you came from. So that is something that maybe the perception that there is one so-called Black America, there really never really was, but the experience of any Black person who came to this country was, you know, made very similar, if not the same, because of the institution of racial apartheid here. And maybe, you know, with the dismantling, at least of some of the more obvious aspects of that, we can pay more attention to the truth of that. You know, there never really was a so-called unified one Black experience.
Kevin, I'll put that to Gene Robinson, but let me ask you if I may. I don't know what your race is, Kevin, but do you see what Gene Robinson is talking about in your life?
Well, I mean, I see it, and it's no surprise. I mean, there's nothing new in the idea that, you know, if you come here from a different part of the world that has not experienced what, you know, Blacks who have lived here and kind of had to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, the racial components of that, you are going to have a different experience. You won't have the same emotional connection. Your experience, as the gentleman was saying earlier, I mean, Black or African immigrants are among the most highly educated that come here. They don't understand how difficult it was to get racial equality in our schools. They don't understand, you know, some of the things about that. I mean, their experience is different, and I'm not, you know, they have other issues in their cultures that definitely, Blacks who grew up here cannot understand.
But Gene Robinson, what do you say to Kevin's observation that there's been differences, segments, from the beginning, however you want to define that?
That's absolutely right, Kevin. It's absolutely right. There was never Black America was never as homogenous as some people thought. If we recall, actually, during the Civil Rights Movement, we all think of Dr. King because Dr. King emerged as the kind of world historical figure associated with the triumph of the Civil Rights Movement. But we forget that there was a multiplicity of civil rights leaders who had a common goal, but had different ideas of how to get there and how to push in this direction and push in that direction. There have always been African Americans. There's always been some economic disparity there. Mm-hmm. I think that has all kind of increased. I think the diversity of Black America has increased, It was never entirely true, but it is, I think, much less true than it was in the past that there is this sort of unity beyond in the political sense. I mean, if you look at Black voting patterns, you see in some polls, 96% support for President Obama, mm-hmm. or something like that. But there are historical reasons for that, and that's also kind of a special case.
Kevin, I appreciate your call. Gene, then put a finer point on it. If there have always been distinctions, I mean, there was never sort of one cookie-cutter mold for what it exactly meant to be Black in this country. And if the splintering, you know, didn't happen yesterday, it's been going on for a while, is it some kind of tipping point you're pointing to? Is there now to the point where there's some sense of unity that's behind us, lost, or what exactly is the new spin of evolution here?
I think the distance, the gap, especially in that central cleavage between the two largest groups, the mainstream and the abandoned, has widened. It's not just an economic difference. Increasingly, it's a physical or geographical difference. It's a social and cultural difference, I think. And I think while it happened gradually with sort of points of punctuation, one of which was the riots in 1968 after Dr. Mm-hmm. King's assassination. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I think we do look up now and we see that at some point in the fairly recent past, I think there was something of a tipping point, or maybe it's just that we're threatening to tip. But I came away alarmed at the prospect that this abandoned group is really being left behind.
And not just by white America, I guess.
By
transcendent Blacks, maybe middle-class Blacks as
well. Well, you know, I mean, think back to the past. Again, there were better educated and more well-to-do African Americans. There were those who were less educated and less well-to-do. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when we all lived in the same neighborhoods, and essentially there might have been a wealthier part of the neighborhood and a poorer part of the neighborhood, but it was the Black neighborhood, at least where I grew up in the South. I grew up in South Carolina. There was a Black side of town, a white side of town, and you were not going to live mm-hmm. on the white side of town. Mm-hmm. And so within the context of segregation, we had an economically integrated community in the sense that there were Black businesses, of course, Black churches. There were a lawyer's family might live next door to a school teacher's family, and on the mm-hmm. other side might be a construction worker's family or a shoemaker or whatever. We were kind of we were closer together in the physical sense. And one of the things that's happened is that as, thanks to the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. the Fair Housing Act, African Americans have options that they didn't have before. And so, of course, people take advantage of those options, which they well should. So people moved out of decaying inner city neighborhoods, those who could afford to do so, and those who were left behind formed kind of an increasingly concentrated node of black poverty and dysfunction that kind of got boiled down and boiled down then gentrified out of the central neighborhoods into the kind of more peripheral neighborhoods, and there it remains.
To the point you say that it's time to adjust and readjust and adjust again, a kind of understanding of what's going on here. Shirley in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shirley, you're on the air with Eugene Robinson. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I was relating really to a comment or from Mr. Robinson's reading from his book.
Mm-hmm.
On this past Sunday, my husband and I are walking down the street, and we're both African Americans,
okay.
Actually products of the South.
Okay.
And we've been in the area for about 30 years. We're walking down Mass Avenue in Cambridge, just going to an event toward Harvard Square.
Mm-hmm.
And as we walk, we tend to acknowledge, and that's truly one of those things that we grew up with in the South, and the African Americans who were walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually made a comment to my husband. Do you know what? Have you noticed that when we're walking down the street, we do tend to acknowledge the African Americans and especially the senior ones.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're passing young African Americans that may look like students,
mm-hmm.
they tend to look away and there's not that acknowledgement. And so I just found it so ironic that 3 days ago, or 4 days ago, we were having this conversation, and then to hear Mr. Robinson read that from his book, just so interesting and so ironic.
You're living it, Cheryl. And if you did sort of give a cock of the eyebrow or a tip of the hat to a young African American passerby, do you think they'd return it, or would they wonder why you were saying hi?
Well, there have been times my husband said, you know, sometimes you just need to have them speak. So I speak anyhow, and I do expect them to speak, but sometimes they don't.
Shirley, thanks so much. Gene, is this going the way of the buggy whip? You know, is this...
It may be. I think thanks to Shirley for her comment. And also, I could tell that she's from the South, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this probably is, as I reflect on it, more a bit more a Southern thing, although so many African Americans have their roots in the South,
sure.
Even those who have lived for perhaps a couple of generations in Northern cities. I kind of think it is, because sometimes you do it. I do it involuntarily, really, without thinking about it. And you sometimes get a look like, you know, why is this old man, saying hello to me? I don't know who he is or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that middle class and maybe what you call transcendent elite, the super rich or the super powerful at this point, are you saying that they are actively removing themselves from what you call the abandoned, not just physically, but, sort of communally in the sense of a community, even if they're not in the same neighborhood anymore? Are they like saying, oh, that's not me?
Well, I won't make that huge generalization because mm-hmm. I know very few people in the mainstream, or in, for example, even the transcendent group, who don't try to do some sort of outreach, who don't give to church programs or participate in mentoring programs or who don't feel that sort of concern for the abandoned. What I think, though, is that increasingly I sense frustration on the part of some mainstream and transcendent African Americans at the fact that they don't seem to be able to work the magic to bring along the abandoned, that it's hard, it's very difficult, and you hear expressions of at times of resentment, but I don't want to imply that that's from a majority. I think the majority is would be frustrated and confused and kind of sad about all of this.
Let's get a call from Steve in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, Steve. You're on the air with Gene Robinson.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'm listening to this, and I'm a younger white male. I'm 25 years old, and, you know, it sounds as if we're talking about the splintering of the black community as a bad thing, but it sounds that, you know, if it is the case, then the civil rights movement was successful in integrating the black community into mainstream culture, and instead of having, you know, a black community and a white community, we just have one community, and you know, to me, it sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, I can understand that reaction, and let's get Gene Robinson's take on it. Upside, downside, good thing, bad thing? How do you look at it, Gene?
Well, you want to take it on balance. Good thing in that what made this possible was the ultimate triumph of the civil rights movement, and no one would take that back. No one would go back to the old days when there were laws against interracial marriage, when there were housing covenants that kept black people out of some neighborhoods, when black people weren't allowed to vote in many places. No one would go back to those days, and we have in many ways made a lot of progress, and so the fact that there can be not just an African American president, but but someone like Richard Parsons. I mean, this is one of my favorite
big CEO
examples.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. Now this is we have the big financial crisis and banks are melting down left and right. And so an African-American president needs an experienced CEO to step in and help out at Citi Group, which was, you know, like all the other banks, is troubled. And
right.
So he and his folks can look around and say, well, here's Richard Parsons, who had run the largest media and entertainment company in the world, Time Warner, an experienced CEO, also African American, and kind of help
kind of
usher him into
yeah.
that job that could never have happened before.
Eugene in Boston. So, Eugene, you're on the air. We'll flesh it out, Gene, but I want to get Eugene before the break here. Hi, you're on the air, Eugene.
Eugene Robinson, congratulations. Eugene Rivers.
Great. Hi, Gene. How are you?
Pastor Rivers, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
First, excellent point. What Gene has expressed, I think, powerfully is an argument that in 1987, Bill Wilson made in a book called On the Declining Significance of Race, where he argued that the structural and institutional factors were creating this division within the black community. One of the things, just in terms of the downside, is that in our inner cities, this is producing an ideological and political leadership vacuum, as this black underclass or those that have been left behind are now left leaderless. And so it's, Gene, thank you, hats off to you for stating powerfully something that has to be part of the national black political agenda, which has traditionally been ignored by our mainstream civil rights organizations for the most part, with exceptions. So congratulations on making an argument. I applaud your courage.
Well, Gene Rivers, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
But a leaderless, abandoned sector of society doesn't sound so great, Gene.
It's not so great, and it's a problem. And, you know, one of the problems is, of course, what sense does it make then? What do we mean when we talk about black leaders? For such a diverse and large group of people, we're talking about 40 million African Americans, more or less. It's such a large and diverse group of people. You're not going to have a single person who can effectively, you know, lead in a sort of grassroots way.
Are you saying it's condescending to say it has to be from the elite?
Is it condescending to say it has to be? No, it doesn't have to be from the elite, but it ought to be somebody, and preferably somebody with some juice to get some stuff done, right? Because there's a lot of things that need to get done.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Washington Post columnist, Pulitzer Prize winner Eugene Robinson, about his new book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. Gene Robinson joins us today from Seattle. And, Gene, lots of callers for you. Let's go to Jacqueline in Boston. Jacqueline, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I think that what's interesting in hearing this conversation is I have a northern experience, and I'm a child. I'm an American, but I'm a child of the emergent group. And I grew up in New York City.
By emergent, you mean immigrant or?
Immigrant. My mm-hmm. parents are both from the Caribbean.
Okay.
And I've never had the experience that he's talking about the kind of acknowledgement of blacks. I used to always say when I was in school, we are not a monolith. Because in my experience, what my Caribbean parents said was, their children were not going to ever be treated the way African Americans were treated.
So you've seen distinctions for a long time. Your parents made distinctions.
My whole life, my parents never wanted to have their children treated the way African Americans were treated. And so I am pleased that we're having this conversation, mm-hmm. but I think contextually, it really is not new. And I do a lot of diversity training. And when I work with Caribbean people and African people, and people say really negative things about African Americans, they go, they're not talking about us.
Well, Jacqueline, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, you've been here long enough now to have seen that there was an important time when I think African-Americans took sustenance from the idea. There may have been differences, but sustenance from the idea of a Black American experience, a Black American history, a Black American tie.
I am American. I mm-hmm. was born. I'm the only person in my family that was born American. And I have really felt the tensions of being, I am an African-American. I was an African-American in a Caribbean household.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult reality to live with. But I also am a middle class. And so I grew up with this Jack and Jill kind of them us kind of grouping where I think in the last 50 years, especially after Brown versus Board of Education, one of the things that I saw is the influx of drugs into the black community.
So when you say them, us, Jacqueline, do you mean white, black, or black, them, us?
Black, black.
Yeah.
Intra-racial strife. And I think there's always been that in the black community. And I think that the southern experience is very different than the northern experience.
Jacqueline, I appreciate your call very much. Gene, it comes back. Eugene Rivers was making this point from another angle. Now Jacqueline saying, look, this isn't new exactly, and yet we can feel something in the weight of it maybe moving here.
Right. I'd throw in a couple of things. First, it's not entirely new. No, it's not. But we haven't really talked about it. It's not a conversation that we've had, and I think it is. I think it's a very important conversation to have now because when we talk about Black America, the conversation still tends to be about the Black America of 50 years ago, and I would argue that even in the context of the Northern experience, it was a less disintegrated community than it is now. And without seeing it clearly, I think we can't talk about it intelligently. And just to throw in one detail, she mentioned Jack and Jill, which is a kind of social club for the black elite or aspiring black elite that's throughout the nation, and so that's what that reference was.
We're hearing from African American listeners about how they're taking it on board. Some from white listeners as well. I wonder how you look at. I mean, when you talk about Black America, you know, this is also a categorization that mattered or was a way that whites sorted out the world. I wonder how you see them coming to terms with this new reality or emerging evolving reality you're talking about. As I got ready for this broadcast, my mind went back to a Bill O'Reilly broadcast, of all things. And this was back just a couple of years ago now. And he went out for dinner in Harlem with Reverend Al Sharpton at Sylvia's, famous African-American-owned restaurant there. And then on his show, he talked about how surprised he was at what he found.
We went to Sylvia's, a very famous restaurant in Harlem. I had a great time. And all the people up there, tremendously respectful. They all watched The Factor. And I couldn't get over the fact that there was no difference between Sylvia's restaurant and any other restaurant in New York City. I mean, it was exactly the same. Even though it's run by blacks, primarily black patronship, it was the same.
They all watched Bill O'Reilly. I wonder, I don't know about that. Maybe not. But that was kind of incredible that he was so surprised. You know, it's like, whoa, what? There's a restaurant. It's like other restaurants. Is that part of coming to grips with what you're talking about, Gene?
It is, but I'm sorry. A number of us who write columns had great fun at O'Reilly's expense when he said that, because that was a pretty ridiculous thing to
wow,
say.
Wow, black people eat out at restaurants.
They eat out at restaurants and they know what fork to use and this and that. I think the understanding of most white Americans had progressed beyond that. So that wasn't exactly a really subtle point he was making.
So what is there for white America to pick up in what you're describing?
I think what I hope white America comes to appreciate is number one, that there is this very large middle class black America, but also that there is a group that hasn't that hasn't made it. And you know, I get a lot of emails from people who are kind of angry and who essentially say, you have a black president now. What more do you people want?
When will you ever be satisfied?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. When will you ever be satisfied? What more do you people want? Mm-hmm. And, here's some answers. You know, there's number one, there's a lot of unfinished business. Number two, if you would, give opportunity is what people want, and once given opportunity, people are able to take advantage of it, and do quite well in this society, I hope some of the people who send those emails at least try to learn something about the community that they dismiss.
And in a way, these lines are falling away. I mean, you write in the book, I have seen the future and it is beige. I've got a web comment here from Ellen. She says, if you lived where I do, she writes, close by a state university with tens of thousands of students, and if you went around by bus watching that population, he would say it's no longer possible to distinguish black from white. She said, you would see a lot of totally mixed racial makeup before your eyes. And that's part of what you're writing about here, Gene.
It is. One of the it's hard to remember, but it was only in 1967 that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that laws against interracial marriage, or what down my way they used to call miscegenation, mm-hmm. which are making it sound really dirty,
right.
that those laws were ruled unconstitutional. There is an obvious increase in interracial marriages. I think the figure is something like 1 in 10 black males who is married to someone of a different race, or the numbers are going up, and so there are a lot of more interracial children of these marriages and relationships who by their nature, by who they are, have a somewhat different relationship to white America than, say, someone like me, who has grew up with two black parents, the whole strictly African American historical experience as far back as we could see, mm-hmm. although truth be told, you know, the first slaves were brought here in 1619. I think the first interracial first miscegenation happened, and certainly by 1620.
But you point out, I mean, these categories,
this was a different kind
of, right? Mm-hmm. But these categories were used to kind of dissolving at the edges, at the very mm-hmm. least, quite mm-hmm. Literally here. Let's get a call from Lindsay, Burlington, Vermont. Lindsay, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a quick question about whether Eugene or not has studied states that are majority white. Vermont is the second whitest state in all of the United States, and I found that people of color here haven't actually fractured, but they've actually banded together just because we're such a small minority that whether you're from Nepal or the Congo or you're a historic African-American resident, that we now all call each other brown and we're actually banding together.
And do you think of yourself, are you a person of color, Lindsay?
I am biracial. My mother is West African and my father is white from New Hampshire.
But you still kind of cluster in what you describe as, you know, brown community?
Yes, because there's a lot of institutional racism here, and there's been such a small community of color that we all need each other to work together, and we all identify as brown and form alliances across color lines.
That's interesting. Gene Robinson, not everybody feeling like, you know, it doesn't matter. Maybe in some environments mm-hmm. it matters in a new way.
In some environments, it may well, and I have not studied that specifically what happens in these overwhelmingly white environments, and that's an interesting phenomenon. You know, I think that people who find themselves similarly situated and confronted with these similar challenges, it's actually encouraging that they find one another and find ways to cooperate in trying to address them.
Here's a web comment from Scott. He says, a close friend of mine is a high school teacher in West Philadelphia in a predominantly black neighborhood, and he's told me that the gap between black African immigrant students and their black American peers is incredibly wide. The racism, Scott writes, he has seen and heard directed at the Africans from the American black students is the hardest kind of hateful racism he's ever heard of in modern American life. Scott says he thinks that's sad. This gets really complicated along many lines, not just those. I mean, you write about affirmative action, and mm-hmm. what are the implications of this sort of changing boundaries and perceptions here? What would you do with affirmative action in this situation, Gene?
Well, you know, I think it's really difficult and not a good idea to try to say, okay, you're black because historically in your family you have this kind of experience here, and you're not black because you're parents just emigrated from Sierra Leone, and so you know, number one, you gets affirmative action. Number two, doesn't. That's a very difficult line to draw. Families are complicated. Situations are complicated. The immigrants, for example,
kidding.
A lot of them don't have a lot of money. But so what would I do with it? I would means test it. I would say I would make that decision knowing that or also believing that there remains institutional and structural racism in the society, and that even privileged African Americans are put at a disadvantage by what remains of racism in this country.
But would you cut your transcendent elite off from affirmative action then? Would you bring in, if you're means testing, would you bring in underprivileged whites into affirmative action? Or is that too far for you?
No, that doesn't necessarily go too far, and I think that's a discussion that we could certainly have. I discuss it in the book in the context of race-based affirmative action. Do we end it? Do we change it? Do we keep it the way it is? And what I think we should do is say that you know, for the son or daughter of a lawyer who married a doctor, and they live in a big house in Spring Valley in Washington, D.C. and they're doing fine. Why are we using resources at this point, any affirmative action resources, to help that child when there is such an urgent need for not just help in college admissions, but for everything from early childhood education, asthma, obesity, family counseling, fix the public school. There's such an urgent need in that abandoned community that I think that's a trade-off the society should make, and that African Americans should make, and we should say, okay, you know, we there may still be racism, but enough people are doing okay that they can forego whatever benefits there are left from affirmative action. We can use those resources to really try to address these stubborn, lingering, and crisis problems of the abandoned group.
We've only got about a minute here, but I mean, you make a stirring call for a kind of Marshall Plan for that abandoned, that really, really difficult abandoned group in really difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. With this breakdown, call it what you will, of Black America, do you think Black Americans will support that? Are they going to feel that solidarity with those African Americans who are in the toughest core of the hard problem?
I don't know. And I frankly made the decision that if I was going to reach a conclusion and based on what I thought would be politically palatable, you know, what I thought could get 60 votes in the Senate next week, that I'd still be working at it. And that it was more important to write down what I think needs to happen. And then we can figure out, is this practical? Can we get the 60 votes? But it does need to happen. There's a crisis. We're losing a whole lot of people, and they're falling farther and farther behind, and we're not even talking about it.
Old threads here, but a new world at the same time, and you state it quite wonderfully. Eugene Robinson, his new book is Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. Gene, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt of Eugene Robinson's book, Disintegration, at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.